Oh, okay, never mind. All right. Please proceed. I think we're good to go.
My technical problem. Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I want to do today is give you an overview of the Pollution Control Agency in terms of our mission, strategic plan, structure and governance, a brief overview of our budget. There'll be more details on that in the budget hearings once the governor's budget is out. But then importantly, the majority of the discussion on our environmental focus, environmental assistance in land, air, and water protection. And so we'll be going through those different areas with you today. First of all, to talk about the mission, it's really quite simple, working with Minnesotans to protect, conserve, and improve our environment and enhance our quality of life. A key point in this mission is that effective on July 1st, 2005, the MPCA was combined with the Office of Environmental Assistance, thereby creating a new agency. And so the pollution prevention part of our job has been much enhanced in the last year and a half as a result of this merger. And many of the ideas and concepts that OEA has been working on over the years are now being much more incorporated into the activities as the MPCA as a whole. And you'll see that as we talk through the presentation. Talking a little about guiding principles, we have a number of principles that we use to fulfill our mission. You know, focusing on priorities and managing for results, actively partnering and leveraging knowledge, ideas, and resources, relying on data for decision-making. Obviously, with science-based decisions, the data and the quality of it is extremely important. And then, of course, integrating economic, social, environmental sciences when developing policy. The result of our regulation has a real impact in terms of economically in the state, and then as well on people's communities, the social aspects. And as we work in terms of that mission, we try to keep those always in front of us. And then finally, we strive for excellence and innovation in our service delivery. We have a continuous improvement effort that's ongoing in the agency in terms to try to get our processes to be better, our results, et cetera. Agency priorities as a part of these guiding principles include obviously identifying and cleaning up Minnesota's polluted lakes, rivers, and streams, working on helping businesses and individuals make better decisions with respect to the products they use and products that are produced, limiting our air pollution, operating our core permitting activities as well very efficiently, and, of course, enforcement and responding to emergencies. We have a strategic plan. You have the cover it from February 2006. And our plan is broken out into five sections. The first one talks about Minnesotans taking actions to protect the environment so that you reduce the pollutants going into the air, water, land, air quality, the condition of our land, and then, of course, a section on water quality and internal improvement as well. Each one of these sections has goals and measurable objectives focused on outcomes. So how much are we going to reduce pollution and by when? The plan drives the work that our staff does on a day-to-day basis. Now we're going to talk a little about some of the agency milestones. Agency was created in 1967, and I think a couple key things here is it'll be the 40th anniversary this year of the Pollution Control Agency. And we were created as a result, one of the defining moments was a number of oil spills on the Minnesota and Blue Earth Rivers in 1963. And as a consequence of those oil spills, in the spring of that year, there was a massive die-off of ducks. In fact, we have a picture in the archives of the governor at that time standing by another individual with quite a large pile of ducks. And that was really the cry for creating the agency and forward on here. In 74, we were set up for programs to deal with generation and handling of hazardous waste. 1983, we had the Superfund program came to the MPCA. And in 1987, this legislature authorized the Clean Water Partnership, which provides loans to local units of government for lake and stream improvement. 1989, waste management became a major issue, and the Office of Waste Management was established. In 1994, the Office of Waste Management became the OEA. So then moving up to recent times, MPCA and OEA were combined. So you can see through the history, over time, programs have been added. In addition, there's been a combination as well. And as a consequence of all these changes, we now have 800 staff in 8 different offices across the state. We have 7 major divisions in terms of the structure of the organization. The industrial division handles our core regulatory programs related to large industrial facilities so that they comply with air and water quality and hazardous waste management. We have the regional division, which is particularly important in working for services for feedlots and watershed organizations and individuals. So you hear a lot about this in outstate Minnesota.
Excuse me, Commissioner.
Yes.
Senator Fredrickson has a question.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Moore, you've listed 800 staff people in the 8 regions, which is good. I like to see it diversified. How many staff do you have in the central office?
Madam Chair, Senator,
Could you start by identifying yourself for our tape and for us?
Absolutely. My name is Leo, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the MPCA. Traditionally, the breakdown has been about half the staff are in St. Paul. That's varied from time to time. We can get those specific numbers to you so that we can give you a firmer answer, but that's roughly how it breaks out.
Madam Chair, at this point, I'm just curious. I'm sure we'll see those budget documents. And there was some disturbance behind us when you said your name, so would you say your name again, please?
Sure. It's Leo Rodis.
Rodis. Okay. All right. Thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Moving on to the municipal division. As the name implies, it works with cities and towns to ensure proper management of wastewater, stormwater, and solid waste to help protect the environment and the citizens. Work includes technical assistance, development of rules and policy, permitting and compliance and enforcement. The Prevention and Assistance Division provides pollution prevention and environmental education. Many of the original OEA staff are a part of this particular division. And the OEA, the former OEA, and the pollution prevention folks here work across the state. Moving on to the remediation division, this particular group of individuals operates programs to clean up pollution in the soil and water from various spills and other activities that have occurred over a long time. So, for example, when you hear about the cleanup at reserve mining, the remediation division is the lead for this kind of work. We have another 2 divisions, the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes divisions. These are the folks, a lot of scientists in this particular area, that do the monitoring and evaluation of the physical, chemical, and biological conditions of the environment. So when you think about stream monitoring and to try and determine what's going on, these are the kinds of folks that are involved in that. And then finally, the Operations Support Division, providing communications, fiscal, human services, folks like myself in the commissioner's office. And in terms of the members of these divisions, what you have behind you are a number of the staff that represent them. So if we have a specific question regarding a division that gets into a lot of detail today, I've got some folks here that can help you out on that.
Commissioner, I think when we had Commissioner Holston here, he introduced all the division heads, and I think that's a nice thing to do, if you wouldn't mind.
Be happy to.
Put names and faces together, everyone.
Hey.
If you, or just introduce yourselves. Whichever.
Rod Massey here is for the operations support.
Mike Sandusky, Environmental Analysis and Outcomes.
Moving back, representing Kathy Sather.
Mark Schmidt from our remediation division.
And Kathy Sather is the division director, and she could make it because she's working on a facility issue up in Anoka County this afternoon.
And I'm the director of the Prevention and Assistance Division.
Warner, Industrial Division.
And then we have the Assistant Commissioner for Air, David Thornton.
David Thornton.
Great, thank you.
Welcome. Moving on to the budget. For the biennial budget, this gives you the appropriations by fund. What we have is $291 million for the biennium. and you see the pie chart breaking out those dollars, you'll note a couple of things. The Environmental Fund is at $117 million, or 40% of our budget. Remediation at 25%. General Fund is at about 8%. What we've seen is that the General Fund is less than it has been in prior bieniums. Prior bieniums, it was up to 15%, 13%. But because of the one-time Clean Water Legacy funding from this legislature last year, that $5 million made the funding for General Fund at about 10%, but it's not an ongoing amount for the Clean Water Legacy. And federal funding at 15% has also started to get more tight as well.
I'm going to want to get back to that.
Moving on to other things that you'd add, Leo, related to the revenue sources.
No, I think we've got another slide that talks about how the dollars are appropriated by media. I think we'll see the next slide.
Will you tell us what all the sources are to raise those dollars? Is that part of this presentation?
Chair, I'd be happy to talk about that in some level. I don't have all the details here,
just
but I'd be happy to walk through that. In the general fund, it's sort of your general, typical general fund receipts. We get a little bit of fees from wastewater treatment plants that go into that fund, as well as environmental enforcement fines, which are appropriate to the general fund. In the remediation fund, these are typically dollars that come to us either through actions or their fees that are paid, or money that's appropriated from the environmental fund into the remediation fund. The federal funds, as Commissioner Moore mentioned, those are federal grant dollars that we get to operate our hazardous waste programs, our Superfund programs, our air quality program, as well as our water quality program. Special revenue is that's essentially the 200 funds that we have in the agency that are essentially receipts collected by the PCA. Either these are general funds, or we also have funds that come into this account from for our voluntary investigation and cleanup program, which is a fee-based program, a fee-for-service program. It's a special revenue account. And the PFA revolving fund, that's a revolving loan account that is used by the PFA to fund infrastructure projects across the state.
A couple other points, Madam Chair, I mentioned about the funding is that majority of the funding for the air programs come from the Environmental Fund air fees. And then about 66% of our general fund goes to water programs. So water's heavily there.
And where does where does the environmental fund money come from?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did neglect to mention that, our biggest source of funding. It's a collection primarily of fees and taxes that are related to environmental issues. So the solid waste tax is deposited into this account. There's also a metro landfill abatement fee. Various water quality fees, those fees that are not directly in the general fund account, hazardous waste and pollution prevention fees. They're generally fees that we collect from those facilities that we regulate in addition to the solid waste tax. And that's the bulk of it.
In terms of the percentages, the solid waste tax is about 55% of the environmental fund, and the motor vehicle transfer fee is about 14% of the receipts of the environmental fund. So those two represent 69%. So those are the bulk of where the money comes from.
Senator Frederickson?
Madam Chair, Deputy Commissioner Rodiz, would it be accurate to say that, say, like 6 or 8 years ago, those fees were put into separate accounts, sort of like freestanding silos, and that those funds were all collapsed and put into the environmental fund to better fund programs across a number of divisions? Is that what happened? I'm trying to
Senator Frederickson, I think that's the next slide.
Oh.
For those of us who like to read ahead. So so maybe we'll let them talk about it, and then you can ask questions if you still have them. That's okay. Go ahead, please.
You want to finish this?
No, that's fine.
Okay. You look at the current level budget, appropriations by program. You see here, for example, the land is the largest one at 32%. The reason for this is the number of the remediation projects are quite large, and they cost a lot of money. And so that's why you see a big amount of dollars here. An example would be reserve mining or some of the work at Flying Cloud, for example. In terms of staffing, a number of the agency staff, water is the largest program. Many of the agency's priority programs fall in this area, and again, 66% of the general fund goes to water programs. You'll see environmental assistance at 15%, and the other ones, air, admin, and support. Add to that. Getting back to Senator Frederickson's question, the environmental fund consolidation was authorized by the legislature in 2003. There were a total of 15 accounts, 7 funds, consolidated or eliminated. And the reason for that consolidation was to provide flexibility to address some of the highest environmental priorities. What happened is, particularly in the water area, there's a water gap, and the agency was unable to meet its commitments in that area. And so the fund consolidation allowed for more flexibility here. And another thing to point out about the funding is that although the number of dedicated accounts that were merged together allows for fewer accounts, there are a couple, such as the landfill cleanup and dry cleaner cleanup fund. So there's a few that are continue to be dedicated to very specific concerns or areas. This next slide talks about budget trends. And as we noted previously, most of the spending comes out of the environmental fund and remediation funds. And note back in the 1980s, the general fund and federal funds accounted for almost half the agency's budget together. And this year, both those are much smaller. Add to that? Gives you a picture of what it looks like. So let's turn to the environmental focus in terms of the agency, why we're here. 4 major areas: environmental assistance, land, water, and air. And in each of these particular areas, we have programs and activities that monitor the resource, prevent pollution, manage it, and clean it up. So you kind of have the different areas. You first try to prevent it, and you manage it where it's going to occur, and then you clean it up. So these are all, this is. And what we found is that during its first few decades of existence, the MPCA focused primarily on point sources, so sources coming out of a particular pipe or stack. And there was a lot of success in terms of cleaning up those emissions, whether from factories, wastewater treatment plant discharges, or operations generating hazardous waste. While that work will continue, the primary challenges that we're seeing today are the non-point pollution sources. And some examples include runoff from urban or agricultural land, poorly constructed or maintained septic systems, and everything to air pollution from motor vehicles. So sources that are very dispersed and not that easy to pinpoint. In general, non-point sources can't be regulated like traditional point sources. They require more newer and innovative approaches and partnerships with other entities, local units of governments, citizens, and others, because it's a much more complex problem or series of problems to deal with. We're going to now look at each of those 4 areas in detail. For environmental assistance, the vision is to take for Minnesotans to take responsibility to protect the environment. Goals include Minnesotans buying green products and services, and that Minnesotans act on their environmental knowledge. What we've learned is that the biggest environmental challenges we face today come from day-to-day citizens' decisions in terms of how they handle their wastes, how we use our energy, how we travel, and whether we buy disposable or renewable products. It really comes down to the individual. And the environmental assistance area of the agency is working to change help the citizens make good decisions so we keep the pollution from coming in the first place. Past efforts in waste reduction have been quite successful. We've had good recycling programs, waste prevention, development of markets for recycled materials, working with counties on waste prevention, education as well. Handling and disposal of garbage, for example, and waste was a hot-button issue back in the 70s. It's led to the creation of a very successful program. In fact, we're number two in the nation in terms of our recycling. We're only behind Oregon, the data. Last year's State Fair, for example, we saw 350,000 visitors come through our eco experience. And the majority of those folks that went through that exhibit said that they were willing to make changes in their lifestyle based on the information presented to them there. This, by the way, was the second largest exhibit in terms of number of visits behind the Miracle of Birth put on by the agricultural folks. And the State Fair folks that were working with us were really pleased that they think that really helped bring in a lot of people to the fair. And I want you to know as well, we are working to upgrade that exhibit for next year, bringing the newest and the latest as well, so it's fresh and new and engages our public in a
Well, given that that's my Senate district that covers the State Fair, I'd really like to see a whole wind turbine instead of just a blade. That would be nice. That'd be a good upgrade. I think there'd be community support for that.
Madam Chair, my staff with their nodding heads are telling me that we are working on that.
Excellent.
So, that's a good thing. I will say that the standing blade did impress my 8-year-old son, and they walked away knowing a lot more about wind power than they did walking up there. Moving into the land area, our vision falls into two main areas: making sure that all waste generated in Minnesota are handled and disposed of properly, and cleaning up areas where they were not. In the 1970s, Minnesotans began to address environmental contamination caused by waste disposal. And what we're finding is that waste produced by businesses are strictly regulated, and we're doing a good job there, both in due to pollution prevention efforts by businesses. The volume of hazardous waste produced has remained level, even though our economic activity has increased. The current waste rate of waste growth is a plateau, though. We're going to be continuing to need landfills in the future, and we need to do actually a better job in terms of recycling. I'll give you an example in a few minutes. But one of the good things in terms of land and cleaning up is that we've actually been recycling land. Back in between 1994 and 2004, the acres of land that we recycled by landowners, and what I mean by recycled is places that we couldn't use because of hazardous substances, but turning them into a place that we can reuse, increased from 438 acres to 55,000 acres. So as a result of our work with the partnerships with these landowners and responsible parties, that's a lot of acreage that's gone back into service where it can be used in a productive manner. But moving on to that trend in waste management, this is a chart over from 1992 to 2004. Our residents recycle about 49% of their waste. And while that's good, when I mentioned on a nationwide basis, the problem is the amount we're recycling is not keeping up with the amount of waste we're generating. In 1991, the per capita waste generation was about 0.88 tons of waste per year per person. Now it's 1.17 tons per person. So people are producing more waste. And in addition, when you look at, even though we're doing a good job in recycling, 75% of the waste that's going into landfills or incinerators is easily recognized as recyclable or combustible. It says we can do a lot more in the recycling area and compost. So while we're doing a good job relative to other states, I'm here to tell the committee that we think we can do better.
Commissioner, we keep interrupting you, but can you just restate that? How much waste do individuals produce in Minnesota, and is that per year?
In 1991, per capita waste generation was 0.88 tons per year, and in 2003, it was 1.17 tons per year.
Per capita.
Per capita. So as a result, is each of us, we're producing more waste.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Moore, on that same topic,
I'm
wondering how much of that increase it is really because of our activities, and how much of it is because of things like increased packaging, where we go buy a pencil and it comes with a big cardboard package with a big bubble wrap on it. And if I want the pencil, I have to buy the whole package. So how much of it is things that we as individuals are producing, and how much of it is foisted on us by the packaging and marketing products?
Madam Chair, Senator, we're going to bring up Kathy Moger, who's expertise is on that very question.
Great, thanks. Welcome to the committee.
Chair, I think she has expertise on a number of areas.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Moger, and I'm the Division Director of the Prevention and Assistance Division. As Senator Fredrickson indicated, we are looking at trying to reinvigorate recycling because of this increasing amount of waste that we're seeing being generated per capita. We're looking at reinvigorating some of the earlier campaigns that the former Office of Environmental Assistance had about shopping wisely, again looking at the kinds of packaging that people have in the products that they purchase. We're also looking at the commercial sector in particular, because our waste composition information is pointing to that sector as having tremendous opportunities to improve recycling. And so we're trying, we're in a process right now with a contractor of going through additional sorting of garbage to figure out if we can target particular sectors or particular kinds of industries to help focus our recycling efforts with those folks. On the prevention side, we're trying to work with companies to make sure that they are designing for the environment, that the packages that they have are easily recyclable, or that they're have the least amount of packaging possible, that we don't have toxics in those packages and so forth. So that's kind of the efforts that we're taking in the solid waste arena from both the prevention and the recycling side.
But do you know, just to follow up on Senator Fredrickson's good question, do we know what's to account for that big increase? You know, what are the big new components? What components of the waste stream are growing?
We're seeing a large, well, I don't know if I can indicate for you today exactly which segments are growing. I can tell you which areas we know are still in the waste stream as far as not being recycled or reduced. The amount of paper waste that we have is actually increasing. We have a tremendous amount of organics that are not being captured through composting or other methods. So we're looking at those two areas in particular for additional work. But the work that we're doing now with this commercial waste composition sort will help us identify other areas to target.
And do you know if it's more the individual consumer that's producing more waste, or is it overall, you know, the whole bundle of everyone in the state, from business to industry to government or whatever?
It's actually all of us. You can't pin it to either the residential or commercial sector, but it seems like the cleanest waste that we're seeing in our initial work is coming from the commercial sector, so that's where we think the most opportunity is.
The cleanest waste?
Cleanest waste as in, yeah, there's an oxymoron, huh?
I'm trying to figure out what you mean by that. The materials that could be reused,
yeah,
or separated?
Exactly, that there's a nice, consistent waste stream that would be easily captured.
Well, our math guru here says, sorry, you're a math guru too, but Don says 6.4 pounds per day.
Per person.
Senator Hahn had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I'm interested in this whole recycling area that you're talking about now. What Cases where lots of things have been recycled that end up not ever finding the market for them and end up going to the landfill anyway. And so you have a process where you put in the cost and effort to go through the effort of collecting and sorting, and because no one wants to buy those things, they end up going back to the landfill. I'm just wondering, what is the status of the people who are in perhaps the marketplace to buy these things? Is there an additional market? We're saying we want to recycle more, but there isn't a market to take those things, and then what happens? Do you have any information about that, that part of this?
Ms. Moger?
So, Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, we also have staff that in my division that are pointed towards market development. We actually have very solid markets in the state for paper, metals, less so for glass, and it's really because our major glass manufacturer in the state, Anchor Glass, has gone through bankruptcy now for the third time, and we're having issues with colored glass in particular. So that is one of the areas that we're trying to focus our efforts on. We have some work being done in the metro area with what's called an optical sorter that helps separate the materials so that they're easily recyclable. They're more easily marketable. I mean, they're are instances where loads that come to recycling markets are rejected because of contamination, and that's why you see your cities and other local units of government really working hard to educate the citizens about what can and can't go into the recycling containers, because if there's too much contamination, the recycling market will reject that load and it has to go to the landfill. So we try and work really hard to make sure that that doesn't happen and keep that contamination to a minimum.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Smolgren, do you have any data that show us, for example, all the things to recycle in a category, whether it's paper or cardboard or glass or metal, how much of that actually ends up being reused by an industry and how much of it does not? I'd be curious to know just how efficient the recycling market is. And I guess one of the concerns I have is that if the market isn't there yet, then are we really accomplishing much by pushing for more effort on the consumer's parts to do things that end up in the landfill anyway? I just want to understand what that looks like. And got some, I guess, statistics or trend data that can show what that market looks like and how saturated it is or how much opportunity there is for things. You mentioned glass is one, for example, and if the current glass recycler is in bankruptcy and doesn't deal with colored glass anyway, then what happens to all the colored glass that people set out on their curb? Where does it go?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that's actually going into some alternative markets right now. Sandblasting is one of those markets. Glass tiles is another typical market for that material. But we are trying to, as I said, enhance the market for that. I can get you the data on the recycling markets and their efficiencies. I don't have that with me today, but I'm happy to provide it to the committee.
Well, it's a good topic for a future discussion in more detail. Absolutely. Senator Dill.
Oh, Madam Chair, Ms. Moger, just on a personal question, our family recycles everything we possibly can. But and the place we bring it to doesn't mind having the plastic and the tin cans and everything mixed together in one receptacle. But one thing I've always wondered about is what about the paper labels that are on the tin cans and the covers on the glass jars that might have to be metal or the cover that's on the plastic milk jug? Is that plastic cap also recyclable, or how do you manage that?
Madam Chair and Senator Dill, actually the recycling processes that we have in place are really good at removing most of those contaminants, either by settling it out of the mix while it's being shredded or prepared for processing, or by somehow sorting it out, either by hand or by machinery. So for the most part, you don't have to worry about labels on your cans or the type of plastic. It'll be handled in the processing facility.
Just one more question. The compost, the little bar for compost seems to be going down. Why would that be? From the 90s to now, it's getting smaller.
Madam Chair, I think that's because we're seeing more organics in the waste stream that could be captured and are not. And so that is actually one of the areas that we're looking at. We've talked about it in our solid waste policy report to you about the need to increase the amount of organics recovery in our integrated waste management system.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, moving on to cleanup program progress. We operate a number of programs to clean up contamination, both at the federal and state level. For example, the leaking underground storage tank program and closed landfill program. Basically, with this slide, what I'd like to show you is that when you look at the number of sites that have been associated with the program, that would be on the right-hand side of the column. And then the number of delisted sites, what it shows is we've made a great deal of progress over the years in cleaning up sites. So, for example, in the state Superfund program, while we have 77 active sites, we've delisted 159. And you see the numbers as well related to leaking underground storage tanks. And so the slides to point out that we've made a lot of progress here, and while we're not done, the number that needs to be cleaned up is a lot less than it used to be.
And does, Commissioner Moore, does delisted mean that they're clean?
Madam Chair, it means that they are clean, and then for some of them they're monitored over time so that they are available for use for a particular given use.
So I recall in the last budget round, there was the budget, I know in the governor's budget, I'm trying to remember, I think we eliminated some Superfund sites, some remediation dollars for some of those, and I can't recall exactly what happened. I don't know if any to those, if those were delisted, because.
Madam Chair, what I believe you're referencing is we decided that we could delay some sites because they weren't either ripe or didn't present as much of a risk as other sites, so that we could take a little more time to get to them. So we didn't; those weren't sites that we delisted. We just put them off for a slightly later date.
That's right. Okay. Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, members, someone at the MPCA can probably answer this. I have a request from one of my cities, the city of Hutchinson, to introduce legislation to ban non-biodegradable garbage bags for picking up compost or leaves and so forth, lawn waste, because the city of Hutchinson has a business where they collect this stuff from many cities, including the city of Minneapolis, and they recycle this by composting it and then rebagging it as fertilizer and sending it back to the market for resale. And it's troublesome to have these black plastic bags in the processing of this compost because some of it gets into the compost and they can't get it out. So they want a law passed that says that the people that are collecting their yard waste and so forth have to use a biodegradable bag. Now, I don't know what the total impact is of that suggestion, but if there's somebody on your staff that can talk to me about it afterwards, I'd like to visit with them and see if that's an idea that has any merit.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, we will find an individual to give you a call and set up a time to further discuss that issue.
Senator Parisel?
Madam Chair and members of the Senator Dill, I recall back, I forgot what year it might have been, but there was a compost operator in the edge of my district who was using biodegradable bags, and they stopped him because I think they didn't hold up in storage or packaging. You know, I mean, there was something about they wouldn't let them use them any longer. They had to go to plastic bag for some reason because I think they were breaking down in hand there or something. Or maybe in storage or transport or waiting to be bought. That's what they wanted to do. hopefully their operation is to be available.
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, Senator Pearsall, maybe the technology's caught up with the day we're in and that maybe they're strong enough to hold up.
Yeah. Let's hope so. All right, go ahead, please, Commissioner.
Moving into the air area, visions that air Minnesota's air is clean and clear. And, of course, clean air means healthier people. Breathing polluted air can cause itchy throats, burning eyes, asthma, bronchitis, and heart conditions, or even worse, can lead to cases of cancer. Clean air also means cleaner water. Mercury and other toxins fall out of the air and settle in Minnesota's lakes, making fish unhealthy to eat. We'll be talking more about mercury in a few slides. In addition, pollutants in the air reduce visibility, a situation called haze. And haze can affect the scenic views in places such as the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, Voyageurs National Park, and Isle Royale. So there's efforts on that front as well. The 1970s Clean Air Act established standards to protect public health for six key air pollutants: sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, particles, ozone, carbon monoxide, and lead. And the good news is that we currently meet all standards for those six air pollutants. But we still have several days each year, for example, where the air is unhealthy in some cities for sensitive groups, those with heart or lung disease, athletes, elderly, etc. And the unhealthy air is primarily caused by fine particulates in ozone. And these particulates are carried by the wind for hundreds of miles, and either they're coming from other parts of the nation or from other parts of the state. And what happens is that mixtures can create unhealthy conditions. And as a consequence, when you're looking at air quality in Minnesota, energy production and consumption is really a big issue and is key to managing air pollution. The state's demand for energy is growing rapidly, and in order to meet that demand, we have more plants coming online. You've seen the governor's energy initiative. I know this legislature is also very interested as well in increasing the renewables, working on the supply side, but also reducing consumption on the demand side. Coal-fired plants are also a source of greenhouse gases associated with global climate change. And as you know, there's many effects related to global climate change that could be very damaging to Minnesota. This slide, next slide, is a pretty key one. What it shows is growth and trends in air emissions. And what you see in the green line at the bottom is the aggregate emissions of nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, volatile organic compounds, and particulate matter. And what it shows is the regulatory programs are working. We've even seen actually a drop over time, despite a growth in energy consumption, a growth in Minnesota's population, a growth in the vehicle miles traveled, a growth in our state's gross domestic product. And so you see, despite the tremendous growth in Minnesota, in terms of managing these pollutants, the state's been doing a good job.
Commissioner, you mentioned that, you know, I think we've had a trend of more air quality alerts in the last few years. And so that's the only thing I'm trying to figure out, how that fits with this. This is a 15% decrease in emissions of these key toxics, but this is nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide, volatile organic compounds, and PM10. Ozone and particulates, where are they?
What's the components, Madam Chair,
of ozone? I don't remember.
With respect to your first question, is that over this time period, the standards have gotten tighter in terms of what's considered a health risk. And as a consequence, one of the reasons for that is, with a tighter standard, you end up with more days where you're not in compliance. Is that right? And then, pardon me, on your second part of your question?
Well, this green line that's going down, the aggregate emissions of these four toxics, does that include the ozones and particulates that you mentioned that lead to air quality alerts?
Madam Chair, the NOx, which is nitrogen oxides and SOx, and VOCs, volatile organic compounds, both of those combine in the presence of heat and sunlight to create ozone. So those are the two main pollutants that
get
to the formation of ozone that causes the unhealthy. The particulates is the PM10, just to its particles size.
It doesn't include the PM2.5.
So. Right. There's other particulates as well.
Smaller ones.
And M. Chair, did that get to your question?
It did, in a sense. I mean, you're suggesting that the reason for more air quality alerts is not increased emissions, not even at the local level. It's that the health standards are higher?
Part of the answer. The other part of the answer is that, especially with regard to ozone alerts, it's weather dependent. So the more hot days you have in the summer, the more you're going to cook the NOx and the VOCs, which is going to create more allergies. So you'll see summers where you have relatively unhealthy air days, even though the emissions are the same as they were the previous year, but you had fewer hot days, so you have fewer unhealthy days.
Okay.
So it's really a mix. And with regard to the regional problem, the emissions clearly are coming down. But as Commissioner Moore said, with reduction standards, I mean, as we gain more understanding of how it actually affects the health of we know more, we standards down, and to alert people when there's a problem.
All right, Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks. Just follow up on that. Would you say that? What would you say is the biggest group that has reduced its emissions? Is it automobiles or some other category?
Mr. Thornton? Maybe you could please identify yourself when you start.
David Thornton, I'm Assistant Commissioner for Air Policy at the PCA. Senator Chaudhry, on a per capita basis, motor vehicle emissions have gone down the most. But because vehicle miles traveled and the number of cars on the road continue to increase, probably from a sector standpoint, the largest reduction in emissions. And I don't have the data in front of me, so I'm using my best professional guess here would be from the power generation sector. We don't have that many at this point in time new power plants in Minnesota, and the power plants that we do have undergone dramatic reductions in their emissions, or some of them are in the process of undergoing dramatic reductions in their emissions.
Thank you. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, you mentioned earlier that in response to Senator Harrison's question about the increasing days of auto compliance has to do with changing standards. And I'm curious to know why the standards have been changed. And one of the comments was that it was a response perhaps to looking at the effects that levels may have on people's health. And one of the questions I think that has plagued, in my view, the whole debate on this issue generally is to try to link what we do and an effect that is discernible in the public. In other words, as we raise these standards, has health increased? Has it gotten better? And what are the data that support the raising of the standard by whatever gets raised and then the result in better improving health? And is there that kind of data? How big is the connection? Is there any kind of cost-benefit analysis to say we put this much cost into our system of maybe it's electric power and it's resulted in this increased level of health? Do those kind of things exist for this whole discussion or not? And if not, or if they do, can we have access to those kind of data? Very interesting to see what that relationship is. Comment on that?
Chair, Senator, the responsibility for setting health-based standards for these pollutants lies with the federal government. US EPA is charged doing that job, and they're responsible for doing it periodically. It's every 3 years. They don't always meet that schedule, but that is a responsibility. And it's a very, very rigorous process. It's a science-based process. They have a science advisory board that guides their decision-making in this area. To consider cost-benefit when setting the health-based standard. Their job is to look at the health issues as it relates to ambient air quality. When EPA then sets regulations, The requirements of EPA to demonstrate their case are quite rigorous. What we do is when they set standards, then we take a look at those standards and we implement them as appropriate. And those standards guide our decision making when it comes to things like air alerts and setting standards and permits and the like. Case in point, with regard to particulates, there's still considerable debate as to whether or not the particulate standard is still protective enough. You can imagine folks on both sides of that argument are pretty vigorous in making their case for EPA. It's an ongoing discussion, but you know, our expectation, I think, is that the particular standard will probably continue.
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, are the standards that Minnesota has identical to the standards or even higher standards I noticed in the mission that you meet or exceed the environmental standards? Does that mean that we have some standards higher than the EPA standards?
Madam Chair, Senator, the standards are the same.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
I wanted to spend a few minutes before we move into water talking about mercury transport deposition. And it's a good one to use because it really talks, it shows the relationship between air and water. There's a complex relationship between our air and water programs in terms of the actual what's going on physically out outside, and what I want to do is talk a little about that. While there's no air standard for mercury, there is one for water, and the standard involves mercury in fish tissue. And approximately half of the listed impaired waters in Minnesota are listed due to mercury contamination that through our sampling of fish. And despite significant reductions of mercury emissions, more is needed. When we, for example, when we survey our lakes, 85% of the lakes and rivers that are assessed for mercury show up to be impaired. So it's quite a high percentage. And efforts to reduce mercury in fish are going to require fewer mercury emissions, not only in Minnesota, but also reductions nationally and globally as well. And we'll continue on with the mercury. So within the state, we have to work, obviously, at reducing in-state emissions, coal burning and energy plants, taconite facilities, and products. To do our part in Minnesota, our scientists have determined that we need to reduce our mercury emissions by 93%. Quite significant. Most of this comes from three sectors, coal-fired plants, taconite processing, and then mercury used in products. In 2006, this legislature passed unanimously the reductions of requiring mercury, a 90% reduction for the three largest power plants. And as a consequence, we'll be cutting the emissions from these plants or the sector's emissions by 1,200 pounds by 2015, which is quite significant. In addition, there's work being done with the taconite industry to reduce emissions there, and the work the DNR is coordinating with a number of different research folks and the industry to figure out how to reduce mercury as a part of those plant emissions as well.
That's kind of ridiculous.
Finally, emissions from products have also decreased as well, approximately 90% in the last 15 years. So there's been a lot of effort, but we need to do even a better job, and there's more opportunities to move forward. The way we're going to be going about on this is we have a group of stakeholders working to implement what's called a TMDL for mercury, and that stakeholder group we'll be getting together this spring, sector by sector, trying to figure out, you know, where these reductions are going to take place. It's going to be a pretty thorough process. And want to let you know we're very engaged in doing this and take it quite seriously.
Senator Chaudhry?
How do we reduce emissions from out of state by our actions here in state?
Yeah.
How can we do that?
Madam Chair, Senator, that is a great question in terms of how to affect our others, other states. The Clean Air Interstate Rule, for example, requires coordination among states in terms of reducing pollutants. So we do have various state groups working together on this particular issue. I could turn to David Thornton, see if you have some very specifics for the senator. But that's one example.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, David Thornton from the Pollution Control Agency. With in particular with respect to mercury, I think that the approach that a number of states have taken, Minnesota included, is to adopt legislation that goes beyond the federal requirements for mercury reductions at power plants. The result of that is that it's going to disrupt EPA's plans for a cap-and-trade program, and it unlevels the playing field to some degree. And the result of that is that industry tends to want to have the playing field leveled. And as more states go beyond the federal requirement, it provides a greater incentive for the federal government or Congress to take action to catch up with what the states are doing. That's another approach that's being taken for climate change, for example. The states that are beginning to adopt goals and initiate activities for climate change greenhouse gas emissions are doing so in the hope that by doing that it's going to create a certain critical mass that ultimately requires the federal government to step in, whether willingly or reluctantly, and to take some kind of a similar step.
Follow-up.
Senator Chaudhry.
Where is Minnesota in terms of the federal standards? Are we equal, weaker, or stronger?
As far as mercury is concerned, we are significantly stronger in terms of emission requirements from our power plants. There are no taconite facilities in the United States outside of Minnesota except in Michigan, so we're working on that. It's still a research project there. In general, our mercury emissions have been reduced much greater than most states from all sectors, including products, so we're doing very well there. In terms of some of the more traditional pollutants, I would say that we're ahead of the average, but not leading the pack. And in part, that's because our air quality here has been generally good, and there hasn't been as much of a need or a health-based need to go that much further ahead.
So, Madam Chair, you've described kind of a long-term averaging out strategy. Is that correct? If we reduce our standards, some others will, and the cap-and-trade program will try and adjust, and over time there will be an eventual reduction amongst all the states.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, in practice over the last 20 or 30 years, it has taken a decade or more for each incremental change in federal regulation on air quality.
So what can we do, Madam Chair, in the immediate future about states that decide to set up a coal-burning plant in their state, but it's on their easternmost border with Minnesota?
Mr. Thornton, you got an answer for that?
I have an answer. It might not be the answer, but I have an answer. Commissioner Moore mentioned the Clean Air Interstate Rule and working with other states to implement that rule. And one of the things that involves is looking at the emissions in other states and how those emissions impact our state and how our emissions, along with all those other states' emissions, impact places like Chicago, where there are ambient air quality problems and where they do not meet the air quality standards. And it's through these kinds of tools that we develop plans that indicate what needs to be done in some of the states around us in order to help us improve our air quality. And we're working on that right now, particularly with respect to visibility. And while there are plans and hopes to build new plants in other states to the west of us, there are also plans to reduce emissions at existing plants in those states. And so that will get at some of the traditional pollutants like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides. I think that I don't have a good answer at this point in time for greenhouse gas emissions, which is something that many states are just beginning to look at and address, and some of the states to the west of us haven't really even taken some of the initial steps that direction.
So last question, Madam Chair. What then, what has been done with Big Stone 2 with regards to what you've just described?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhary, we have been commenting following that, the developments in that plant, and have been commenting on it. And in part, some of our comments have led to them planning to reduce emissions at the existing unit in order to offset emissions from the new unit. That, again, as I said, addresses some of the traditional pollutants, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, but it doesn't address greenhouse gases. The governor has indicated his interest and concern and hope that new power plants like that that are serving customers in Minnesota would also look at offsetting their greenhouse gas emissions if they are going to be expanding. And I believe that the folks behind the Big Stone 2 project have been informed of that wish.
Senator Chaudhary, I know the Commerce Department has also weighed in on that proceeding, but I think more on the cost issues, if I'm understanding it correctly, maybe on CO2 as well, or maybe you did this jointly, but I know that they have, you know, taken a contrary position to Big Stone at this point, I think because of cost issues. At least that's what I've been told. So I don't know exactly what they said or what the details are, but that's what I've heard from their staff.
Madam Chair, another question. Hasn't California prohibited power to be imported that is produced from coal-fired plants?
Mr. Thornton?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhary, I don't know that I can respond too exactly to that question. I believe that there legislation on greenhouse gas emissions, Assembly Bill 32, does address emissions that are generated in order to supply power to the state, but I'm not exactly sure the details of how that works. We can certainly look into that and get back to you on that question.
Thank you. All right.
I got a few more questions, but let us move on.
Please go ahead.
Moving to the last major media, water. Vision, of course, is Minnesota having clean, sustainable surface and groundwater. We're a water-rich state. We have 92,000 miles of streams and 12,000 lakes. And when MPCA is looking at water quality, we're looking at assessing the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of lakes. And standards are addressed to answer three specific questions. Does the water support healthy aquatic life? Is it safe for swimming and other activities, water-based activities? And then are the fish safe to eat? When you combine those three, really give you a good picture of what the water's like in terms of water quality and pollutants. As you know, we have, based on our monitoring so far, we have a number of lakes and streams that are impaired, just over 1,000 lakes and just over 280 streams are considered impaired. And more than 80% of the pollution for these impaired waters comes from non-point sources. When we talked about runoff from lawns, roads, fields. And so requiring getting a commitment to reduce this non-point solution really is going to involve all Minnesota citizens. In addition to traditional pollutants, we also have some other kind of water pollutants such as pharmaceutical chemicals, metals and household cleaners, even pesticides that we're not sure in terms of the amounts and the impacts that they have. In other words, the concentrations This is an area that more research is being done by not only the MPCA, the Agriculture Department, and other agencies, state and federal agencies, and we're working closely together on that. Minnesota is beginning to investigate and monitor for some of these chemicals, but frankly, there's a lot of this area we don't know a lot about yet, and so it's a new emerging area. What I want to move to next now is the progress that we've made regarding discharges from wastewater treatment plants, for example.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Moore, how many, you say we have 1,000 impaired lakes. How many lakes have been assessed? Have we assessed all our lakes?
Madam Chair, Senator, we have not assessed all our lakes and streams. And is Mr. Reitz here? We have assessed 16% of our water bodies. So we have a long ways to go, lakes.
When you listed the three main areas that you're trying to, your mission that you're trying to protect, I don't think I heard you say drinking water.
Madam Chair, I did not say drinking water.
Is that part of your job or not?
Madam Chair, that drinking water standards are handled by the Department of Health.
So you don't have any role in enforcing or monitoring the safety of our drinking water or the pollution levels in our drinking water?
Madam Chair, we work closely with the Department of Health in terms of on the pollution side of it, but in terms of the water quality standards for drinking, that is their particular role. And we work very closely in combination with our role and their role.
Okay, so you maintain do monitor that. Pollution in the groundwater as well as the surface waters. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Go ahead.
This chart shows you trends in water discharges from 2000 to 2004. And what you see is the major wastewater treatment facilities, they represent about 85% of the total volume of discharges from point sources. So when we're looking at this chart, you're covering a majority of it are those wastewater treatment plants. And what we've seen is a 17% overall decline in the loading of waters in terms of, you see a downward trend, for example, total suspended solids. Another one, biochemical oxygen demand discharge to the state from major facilities decreased each year since 2002, where it peaked at about 4,900 kilograms. But basically what I want to show you on this chart is, for the most part, the trends are dropping. You'll see a note, the difference there in nitrate, nitrogen. It's been a flattening and a slight increase.
So can I just ask, I'm trying to understand how much pollution is coming out of wastewater treatment plants. I mean, you know, sort of a average citizen would look at that and say, okay, we thought that wastewater treatment plants clean the water and then it doesn't come out again until it's clean, but obviously that's not the case. And I'm wondering if you can answer this now, or maybe this is something we need to get more information on later, but, you know, how much, you started off by saying wastewater treatment plants, I think, are the main point source of these?
85% of the total volume from point sources come from wastewater treatment plants. So, right.
After it's treated.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And it's going into our surface waters at that point. So that seems like not something that the average Minnesotan would think makes sense. And maybe we just sort of get used to that around here because it's so expensive to build those plants. And I don't know, but I'm very interested to learn more about how we can reduce that number, because I think we should have wastewater treatment plants that really clean water. That doesn't seem like too high of a goal to ask for, does it? Is that impossible?
Well, Madam Chair, just to clarify, the 85% figure is of the universe of point sources, 85% of those are the wastewater treatment plants. The other 15% is general like industrial sources. Mm-hmm. Point sources actually represent a relatively small percentage of what's actually ending up in the waters, because around 80% is coming from non-point sources.
Sure.
So what we try to do, and we can certainly get you more data on exactly how this breaks down in the point source arena, is we make sure that water that is going to be emitted from our treatment plants doesn't degrade the water, and further than it already is, or if it does meet standards, to make sure that continues to be the case. We have an issue of a wastewater treatment plant that's emitting too much, and it's degrading. We have a responsibility to make sure that they have limits in their permits that don't allow it to happen. That's obviously an iterative process that we could certainly get you more data about how cell plays out within the source fraction of the problem.
Yeah, and I think it's important to keep that in perspective, that it's a smaller piece of the problem. But because the state invests so many millions and millions of dollars in wastewater treatment, it seems to me, and it's such a high priority for so many communities. I mean, we hear that year after year from Senator Vickerman and lots of others. It would be nice if we could understand better what standards exist for wastewater treatment and if there's ways of improving those standards.
Madam Chair, we'll get you that information. And I think the point is also important in the terms of us needing to tell the story not only to the legislature but citizens, mm-hmm. in terms of what is prevented as a result of our permits and then also what's continuing to go out, so that they can make good choices about where we want to go next. So we will follow up on that.
Thank you.
The last few slides, we're going to talk about a couple examples of areas where we have non-point pollution and we've made progress. I thought it'd be good to end our presentation part of the discussion, at least, and showing some success stories. Hawk and Beaver Creeks, and you'll see the map in terms of where those are, in Minnesota, they've been listed as impaired because of high turbidity, mainly due to too much sediment and phosphorus washed into the creeks. And there's been more than a half a dozen projects undertaken in these creeks over the last 5 years designed to encourage local landowners and producers to enroll in conservation programs and restore wetlands. And, for example, we have 22,000 acres enrolled in conservation reserve enhancement programs and CRP, dealing with these kinds of issues in these watersheds. And as a consequence, monitoring data shows that there's a 40 to 60% reduction in sediment and a 20 to 25% reduction in phosphorus in these two particular creeks. Note that, for example, the fecal coliform levels are still too high, but we want to point out is due to the work of the citizens and partners, it's going in the right direction. We're making progress, for example, in this watershed. Another example is the Minneapolis Chain of Lakes. Here studies showed a non-point problem of phosphorus and sediment as a primary concern. As a consequence of a public education campaign, constructing sedimentation basins and wetlands to reduce sediment and nutrient loading, shoreline erosion control, alum treatment of lakes, and improved street sweeping practices, there's been a 50% reduction in pesticides and stormwater, significant phosphorus reductions, and increased water transparency. So, for example, lake transparency increased from 1 to 2 meters to 2 to 3 meters. More work needs to be done in this particular watershed, but the key here is that we're making progress, where the citizens get together with local units of governments and the PCA, federal government, we can make progress, and that there's a hopeful story to tell about Minnesota's waters that are impaired. Incidentally, the cost for this restoration is about $12.4 million, and $1.5 million of that was from state and federal funding. There's a question?
Senator Parisot.
Chair, Mr. Moore, I see you have on that Chain of Lakes, maybe still on the same slide, you have Harriet Calhoun and Cedar. Is there more than one Cedar Lake? I mean, there are a lot of sand lakes, fish lakes, gosh, I can't think how many are multiplied around, but is it Cedar Lake that's in Scott Carver County?
This is the Minneapolis chain.
It sounds like Minneapolis, but I don't know how many Cedar Lakes yes. are out in our state.
A lot. Madam Chair, yes, this one's in Minneapolis.
All right.
Finally, talking about the pressures and challenges. We're finding that about 40% of our assessed waters are listed as impaired. And while that's at the national average, we have a lot of water, and it's our job to reduce where there's impairments to get them back to water quality standards. There's a lot of costs in terms of assessing, protecting, Waters doing the TMDL development and restoration. In addition, as many of you know, we have the Annandale Maple Lake Court decision. And what happened there is the court ruled that the particular way that MPCA had looked at trading pollutants didn't appear to be appropriate under the Clean Water Act. And that's before the Supreme Court now, and we're waiting their decision. As a consequence of waiting for that decision, there's a number of treat wastewater plant expansions and proposed that are not able to go online until the court rules in terms of the appropriate way to handle this situation. And the reason I put that case there is it has large impacts in terms of across the state, well into northern Minnesota, regarding wastewater treatment in Minnesota. Similarly, stormwater is also a very big issue that we're going to be addressing in the coming years. There's a large impact to urban development on water quality and a growth in the number of regulated parties that would be municipalities with respect to stormwater management. So these are two big areas that the MPCA over the coming years is going to be placing a lot of focus, not only as a state agency, but with our partners at Bowser, Department of Natural Resources, Agriculture, and then also our local partners, whether it's water management organizations, districts, SWCDs, municipalities, and cities.
You know, I was I have a sister who lives in New Jersey, and she told me that her saga of trying to build a patio in her backyard and how strict the rules are at the local level in her community for the square footage of impervious surfaces that are permitted for just a resident to get a permit. And do we have? I'm just wondering if we have any kind of regulations like that in Minnesota. Are you aware of regulations like that for individual communities?
Madam Chair, we could certainly get you more specific information. I don't know that we have an inventory of all local ordinances and regs, but all I'll say is that as the state has increased its regulatory attention, largely through what we call MS4 permits, which is the stormwater that we issue to cities. Many cities are in the process of adopting ordinances that more effectively regulate stormwater pollution. Where I live in Minneapolis, there are a different fee structure that applies to homeowners depending on the surface you have in your home. I'm certain that there will be additional regulations. I'd be happy to get you whatever information you have on that.
Just curious. Yeah, thank you. Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, I believe that part of the answer is what the DNR has been doing in terms of research around lakes as to how much impervious surface you can have before you start to compromise lake water quality. Mm-hmm. And my recollection of the research is that when you start to exceed 10% of your lake lot with impervious surface, that's where you begin to start to compromise water quality. So there was a compromise rather than, you know, there's hardly any lakeshore lot anywhere around that has less than 10% impervious surface. That's a very high standard. So I believe the number they settled on was 15%, which is, I believe, the DNR's current recommendation on lakeshore lots. You should have a lot big enough so you don't exceed 15% impervious surface on that lakeshore lot.
Well, and that includes your home,
the house,
right?
The roof, the driveway, the boathouse, the patio, mm-hmm. the whole works. Mm-hmm. So that if you look around this state, there's very few lakeshore lots that have that standard. But my county of Meeker is adopting that standard probably within the next few months so that no more lakeshore lots will be allowed to be sold unless they have less than 15% impervious surface.
And I assume some, like Minneapolis's regulation, probably applies to the whole watershed, or at least to the whole municipality, which is maybe encompasses more than one watershed. I don't know. It's not just lakefront property. Senator Fredrickson, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, we talked about the percent of impervious surfaces when we were dealing with Eagle Creek a number of years ago. I think the result of that was that there was an ordinance that did not restrict, I don't think it restricted the impervious surface, but what it did do was require that water coming off that new subdivision could not go into Eagle Creek, but had to go directly to the river. Mm-hmm. And the point being it would raise the temperature of the water in Eagle Creek and destroy the trout habitat.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been a percent of impervious surface in there. In their ordinance, I don't remember that.
Well, just
Senator Dale.
One more comment on it. There's been a group studying this impervious surface issue that was put together by the DNR, and I believe they're working up in the Brainerd Lakes area or somewhere in that part of Minnesota, and met for a period of many months, maybe a year or more, to decide what the standard should be. And I believe the standard is, as I just described, 15% or less is what is now required or recommended for a lakeshore lot.
Very interesting. Thank you. All right. Are you all done?
Madam Chair, I am. I'll leave you with this comment. And when we got talking about the budget, I did neglect to mention in a slide, the MPCA is governed by a citizens board as well as the commissioner. And that board is 9 members. Commissioner, I chair it. The board, other board members are appointed by the governor, and they're confirmed by the Senate to 4-year terms, and they oversee examples of contentious environmental review and permitting issues. So we do have a public, a citizen board that is involved in our activities. And then lastly, EPA's role with the MPCA is also very large. For state agencies, we, for example, are the delegated agency for Superfund cleanup, air permitting, and water permitting programs. So the EPA delegates its authority to us. So we do a lot of work, and there's oversight of the EPA of our work as well. That concludes our presentation.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Questions,
Chair,
Senator Wickerman?
Probably doesn't even pertain to this, but you know what? If you've been watching the paper, what happened to Monticello when they lost that all that power and it shut down? Who is that under? Is that under like a atomic regulation some way, or do we have anything to do with that in the state on those regulations?
PUC.
Nuclear plant licensing is mostly a federal issue, but we certainly could have oversight authority. I mean, that's more in the Energy Committee, but it's certainly something we can take a look at if you're interested.
Oh,
I think
Chair,
it's definitely within
curious,
our purview
who does watch
as
that?
The legislature.
We watch it.
A lot of the regulations are federal, but we, you know, we have a responsibility to oversee it as well, I think. All right. Thank you very much. Senator Dill.
I have one question that has to do with manure.
One?
This is the first and, one of the session from you. We've been waiting.
We're not in Ag Committee today.
Well, yesterday was Turkey Day at the Capitol. Yesterday was Turkey Day at the Capitol. The turkey producers were here. And I understand that regulations evolve with and have to change with new research and so forth, and it takes time to really figure out where the facts are, because research has to be duplicated by more than one researcher in more than one location and peer-reviewed work and so forth. But what I was told yesterday by the turkey producers was that they are questioning whether or not the stockpiling rules for turkey manure are currently appropriate based on recent research done by Dr. Moncrief at the University of Minnesota. And what they said was that there was always concern about stockpile manure and rain coming down, snow coming down, and washing nutrients away from the stockpile site, causing some kind of pollution problem. And based on what they said, Moncrief found that the turkey manure is so good at absorbing water that it would take 30 inches of rainfall falling on that stockpile manure before it starts to run off. In other words, it could hold that much rainfall before it became saturated and it started to run off. And they were questioning whether current stockpile rules are appropriate if that research proves in the long run to be valid. So I'm wondering if there's any thought about changing the rules for stockpile manure.
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, I don't have the answer to that question, but what I will do is work with our Agricultural Policy Director, Wayne Anderson, to get on that topic and get back to you with the specifics. That's I've not heard that before, and we'll look into it.
Senator Torres Ray.
Madam Chair, I don't know if this is a question everybody knows, but I don't know.
There's no bad questions in this committee, so please
but
ask away.
I would like to know about the coordination for the water, the efforts that the DNR presented to us recently and the efforts that PCA is pursuing for assessing the lakes. Are they coordinated? Are these efforts coordinated, or each agency has its own process to assess the lakes and the pollution in the lakes and how the lakes have been assessed? I would like to know if there is a coordination.
Is it Galen Reese? Madam Chair, Senator, there is coordination among the agencies. And for example, when we're assessing water chemistry, MPCA has that role. The assessing the biota in a particular stream, DNR has that role. For lakes. And mercury in fish tissue, we share it among DNR, MPCA, and the Department of Agriculture and Health. So we are coordinating it at the local level and determining who is the best entity to do it and sharing those responsibilities. Mike Sandusky, a director of the Outcomes Division, if you want more details, could share here as well. And in addition, on the budget, which is going to be released next week, we are also coordinating in terms of budget requests and who's doing what portion of the work.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? What are we doing Tuesday? I think that's right. Okay, our next committee is next Tuesday, and Senator Kubley will be having a hearing in the Energy Subdivision next Tuesday. So I think all of you should know which subdivision you're on, and if you don't know, just ask Don Jarofsky, and he'll let you know. So some of you don't have to be here for that if you're not on it, but you're always welcome. Everyone's always welcome to attend all the subdivision meetings. They're all very good, interesting topics. With that, the meeting's adjourned.